Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 274 featuring Mike Golden of Three Marks, who is an awesome guest. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast, who are traditionally listening to the podcast, this is your opportunity to see the podcast. This is our first inaugural video version of the podcast that we're doing. So stop it and go on YouTube and check it out on YouTube if you want to check it out, because it's pretty fun. You can get to see Kristen and I talk, right, Kristen?
Yeah, it's so fun.
Yeah, so much fun. So Mike was a really great guest. He's an incredibly intelligent person and really fun to talk about in terms of business. He was going to be a guest for us at Total Chaos. Unfortunately, as you guys know, that event got canceled, but we were excited to have him on as part of the podcast. So Kristen, why don't you tell us what your thoughts were on that podcast that I recorded with Mike?
Hi. Well, I love the podcast. And Mike, I've got to know him for the last few months because I've been working with him a lot on Total Chaos. So it was interesting just hearing about his career and kind of how it went from philosophy to 3 years on a fishing boat in Alaska, back to art and architecture, and just being from D-Box and Kit Bash and now having his own company, Three Marks. I really like how he deals with clients. It's the client and artist relationship. The way he explains it and does it, it's different than most people. But I think it makes the process a lot easier and happier on both platforms.
Yeah, he's definitely, I think you nailed it. It's really the way that he approaches clients very differently. He makes them, He feels like he's offering them something completely different, but giving them a lot more value. But really, what he's doing is not that much more. Mm-hmm. But it definitely has a great relationship. Anyone who's going to be out there starting a business and selling services, like creating images for customers, could definitely learn a lot from Mike's process. Really cool guy. Really nice guy, too. We're up there in Portland, Maine. So this was one of our distant podcasts, which is why we decided to record it on video. So it's a lot of fun. Definitely recommend it. Now, we do have some big announcements. Kristen, what is the first big one?
All right. So V-Ray 5 for 3ds Max beta is now available.
That's right. That is a huge deal. Mm-hmm. That is a huge deal, huge deal. I have been writing some blog posts about it. There's some big things going on in it. One thing I would definitely say is that it's got the new frame buffer in there, which is a huge change. It is the main way that you interact with your renders. And it has a lot of interactivity in it, including the new light mixer built right in, a completely new layered system of looking at and manipulating your renders. It's a big deal, guys. It's a really fun, cool stuff. There's also a lot of changes being done on the materials. It's making it super fast, including an entire new material library with something like 500 plus material. I think there's more. There's a lot of materials in there that are available for people to drag and drop into their scenes. So there's just a ton of work that's been done and amazing stuff on Teams. And if you're asking when is it coming up for Maya, or when is it coming up for Revit, or when is it coming up for SketchUp or whatever, it's all coming. Don't worry. It's all coming, trickling out. We always traditionally start with Max because that's the way we've always done it. And we don't try to release everything at once because it'd be a nightmare. So every few weeks, it'll be another product coming out. But this is the first one for V-Ray 5. And yes, some people were shocked to find out that V-Ray Next was actually 4. So we skipped the number and called it Next. okay, so a couple of other announcements. What's going on, Kristen?
All right, so we've announced this the last few weeks, but the education collection is out. And this includes all V-Ray products except for Katana and Nuke. And we do have, it is for Phoenix, for Maya and Max are also included. But it's $150 a year for this.
Right. So if you have, if you're an educator or you are in school and you're currently studying and you wouldn't, you know, basically have an EDU address, you can get V-Ray, all of V-Ray, with the exception of Katana and Nuke, but most people are not many people are using those. But you can get pretty much all the packages of V-Ray, including V-Ray for Unreal, V-Ray for Modo, everything. But you can get those for $150 a year. It's a great, great deal, really good deal. So go ahead and check that out. But if you do not have an EDU and you'd still like to learn V-Ray for Maya, you have another option. What is that, Kristen?
So it's V-Ray Personal Learning Edition is out for Maya. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And that is free, completely free. So you can get the PLE license of V-Ray for Maya And there are definitely restrictions in there, but it's plenty good to be able to do, to learn, even create your own personal projects. That's the only restriction. You can't really use it for commercial projects, but it's really cool to see what that, to have that ability for people to check it out. So check it out, V-Ray for Maya PLE edition. Do we have any other announcements? I don't think so, right?
That's all. Mm-hmm.
That is it. Okay, so remember, we are trying this new podcast in video format. If you guys like it, let us know. We'd like to do it more. It is definitely more work on my side, so I need justification to do all this extra work. And for Kristen and I to look our prettiest for you guys every week. Yeah. So let us know what your thoughts are. We'd love to get your feedback. Go on YouTube or just let us know on our stations. And where can people get in touch with us, Kristen?
All right. So you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys just want to email us and you don't want to go into social channels and put comments on, you can just email us. That's pretty easy. labs@chaosgroup.com is our email. Send us your ideas, your thoughts, whatever. Give us a rating. Give us a rating on YouTube. Give us a thumbs up. I think that's what it is on YouTube, right? It's a thumbs up, right? But if you're on Apple Podcasts, give us a rating. We would love to hear from you there. And, give us a review and share us with your friends. All right. With that being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Mike Golden.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
The digital to analog Polaroid is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and if you really think about it, it's kind of ridiculous that I'm basically taking, there's a lens that's going through you, right? That's a lens that's doing the video camera. And then that's going through this screen. And that's coming to me. And then I'm taking a screen capture of that. Then I'm going to transfer that to the cloud to this phone. And I'm going to take this phone and place it onto a thing. And the output is a Polaroid. And then I take that Polaroid and I scan it with an Epson scanner. And that becomes, this the whole is so ridiculous.
That's like the story of why Kodak's still alive, but not doing amazingly.
There you go. It is kind of hilarious if you really think about it.
Oh, absolutely. It is.
Well, cool, man. This is great. This is great. How are things for you?
All in all, not bad. I got to be honest. I work from home. My wife works from home. We have the baby home now. So that's a change.
Yeah.
And obviously like works, jobs are getting canceled or postponed or kind of like, we'll get back to you in a month or two.
Right.
So that's not awesome, but I got my girls at home, so plenty of family time, and just kind of trying to enjoy myself and stay productive. So we'll get through this, How about you?
It's kind of cool. Actually, I've actually been able to work a lot from home, which is, my job kind of enables that to happen. I've been saving 2.5 hours a day of traffic,
I mean, this LA is a traffic. Blessing to everyone in LA.
Yeah, I know. So that's kind of nice. Kids doing school from home is a little bit more disruptive.
How old are your kids?
10 and 13, almost 14. And
so are you teaching? Are you doing the homeschooling thing?
They're doing homeschooling thing. My wife's helping out with that. Unfortunately, my wife has been furloughed for now because of they can't technically move an entire flame out to our house right now. Yeah. So that's not going to work. But we're figuring that out. So she's helping out with that thing. I am actually recording this podcast from my kid's bedroom because it is actually the best soundproofing around because of the giant bunk bed that's in front of me.
Bunk bed, lots of comforters.
Yep, lots of comforters, lots of stuffed animals and stuff like that. So that's helpful. But that's basically where we are. So, it is what it is.
Yeah. I feel like, there's not much that we can do about it. My sympathies really go out to the people that are a little bit bigger than me studio wise,
right.
small firms that have like four or five people and don't have the money to keep everybody on through this. And I can't imagine what they're going through, but
right.
You know, for my part, I'm just trying to stay positive and
yeah,
make some artwork in the free time.
Hopefully we'll learn something from this process at some point. Anyway,
I'm reconnecting with a lot of old friends that I haven't talked to in a long time because of this. Now that video chatting and having a beer digitally is kind of the normal,
right?
You know, I moved so much growing up that my friends are scattered all over the country. So friends that I talk to like once or twice a year, I've had like three beers with in the past week, you know, like each one of them.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, it was interesting is because I've, as you know, I've been sort of reluctant to do the podcast in remotely. But obviously it's like, well, either we cancel the podcast for a while or we figure out a solution. So I looked at this, which is Squadcast, because there's two things I like about doing it in person. One is I can control the audio quality because I get all the mics myself and everything is good. Mm-hmm. And then two is that I can do I can see the person and we can interact a little bit better. But then I found this, which is pretty cool. The Squadcast system is awesome. And what it does, and I'll explain it to you. I think it was explained in the email, but basically, while we're recording, this is basically like a Zoom or a Skype or whatever. But while we're recording, it's actually recording the uncompressed audio file of your channel and my channel separately on our local devices. Mm-hmm. And it's live updating or uploading that as we go so that I get a clean audio from the end. I was like, that's good. Right.
And separate channels.
And I can mix it myself and I don't get the compression that you get from the horrible Skype calls. But, so that's a good thing. So, but otherwise, I mean, obviously it seems like you have a very good internet connection. Your video quality is superb and your audio is clean and your latency is almost zero from what I can tell.
You jinxed us, but you know, I'm in Portland, Maine, so it's usually pretty good, but not amazing. Not amazing.
I'm just glad it's been about 5 or 6 months ago that I upgraded my internet at home to be fiber. So, it's amazing. Big difference. I'm just glad I got it in time.
When I left New York, we had Fios at New York. So like at home, we had like 100 up and 1,000 down or whatever. Right. And in my office, I was in a WeWork when I was there. Mm-hmm. We had something ridiculous, like 1,000 down and 500 up. It was instantaneous for like gigabyte downloads. And then here we're sitting at like 10 up, 100 down. And I'm like, if I pay for two, is there a way that we can double all of that? And they're like, there's no way to do that. I'm like, there's got to be a way to do that. But
well, it's working. I got AT&T fiber, and I'm getting, and I think I'm paying like 75 a month for it. I'm getting 300 up and 300 down.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm paying the same for
and the only reason I didn't go to gigabit is because like most of the devices in the house are on Wi-Fi, so they wouldn't take advantage of it. Wi-Fi is not fast enough for gigabit.
My internet's faster than a Wi-Fi connection. 5G's not getting it done.
Yeah. Anyway. That's enough geeking out about the internet. Let's talk about you, Mike. How are you doing? Besides that, let's get a little bit of history. Let's get a little let people know a little bit about yourself. You've done a lot of different things in your life.
I've been a little all over the place. It was not a straight direction at all. I was born in 1980. No, we're not going to go that far back.
We're not going there, but we can go where what's inspired you to do what you do.
I mean, you know, before I got into like really any type of like visual art in undergrad, I did philosophy and creative writing in Chicago. And, you know, from there, I fished on a boat for 3 years in Alaska. Really? Yeah. Charter fishing boats, to be clear, not the deadliest catch stuff. Wasn't risking life and limb.
Oh, so you were doing charter fishing, like sports fishing?
Yeah. Sport fishing in Alaska for like halibut and salmon for the most part. Nice. And after a couple of years of that, I'm like, you know, I always liked architecture and I liked fine arts and I don't want to be a fisherman for my entire life. And so I went to get a graduate degree in architecture, and within the first couple of weeks realized that I don't really enjoy designing and I don't think I'm that good at it from an architectural standpoint. But the image making I get really excited about, like all the design work is just a means to get to the point where I get to make an image of it.
Right.
And so, you know, I finished my degree there, but had no intention at any point going into actual design, architectural design.
So you got into the CG part of it pretty quickly, I'm assuming?
Really? Like, I opened Photoshop and Rhino at the same exact time. And this was it was before V-Ray 1.6.
Okay.
I'm not sure which V-Ray it was. But we were learning Rhino and V-Ray, and I was learning Photoshop at the same time in design school. And yeah, so as soon as I got out of school, I applied to ArcViz jobs, architectural visualization jobs, which took me to D-Box, 3DS Max and V-Ray.
Yeah.
3DS, learning 3DS Max was a struggle. You know, it always is. But that's really where like my art career or my visualization or CG career began, was at D-Box in New York. And I spent 2 years there, and it was a absolutely eye-opening experience. I credit a lot of what I've been able to do since then as a result of my time there at D-Box.
That's awesome. I'm actually going to do a podcast with Matthew Bannister.
He actually mentioned that to me the other day. I am looking forward to that conversation very, very much. He's got some wisdom packed back there. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's cool. So
yeah.
So tell me a little bit more. So you were at D-Box, and how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years, and I fortunately got to work very closely with Matthew, who's obviously the founder, and I'm not sure what his title is now. CEO, CCO, Matthew and Keith. And so I got to work on a lot of editorial stuff and kind of really start to develop an eye. I left there to start my own thing. Cause I wanted to kind of have the freedom to play, not so much with the creative style, but the client relationship, which obviously in a big studio, I can't just go in and do anything I want anytime. Right. Like there'd be some implications to that. Right. But I ended up working for a year for Thomas Johansson, the architect in New York City, helping him with presentation visuals, which wasn't really planned. It was kind of I was going out on my own, and in Godfather speak, he made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
Okay.
And so I did that for a year and a half, and I made, I think, in the course of that time, like 300 or so images, close to that. So I made a lot of images. Had a lot of time to like actually develop a process that worked for me in efficiency. And I was doing a lot of freelance. And at that point, I got a job that was big enough to warrant going out on my own in New York City. And so me and my friend Mike Glaudeman did that first project. It was like 30 some odd images, took about 6.5 months. And so that was the beginning of Three Marks, which has been running ever since.
So what year was that about?
That would have been 2014.
Okay.
I'm always impressed by the people like, oh yeah, back in 89, like, how do you remember what year things happened? yeah, so 2014 or 15.
Okay.
14. And so that's been running ever since. And, I kind of, paused that for 2 years and was working with, Kip Bash as their head of 3D.
Yeah. So how did that relationship happen? Because I know Max and I, you know, he's a great guy. I met him actually through Keely, believe it or not.
Oh, it's a small world. And now Keely and Allie are together, which is a fantastic thing. Max, so we actually met. I started my Droki account, which is where I just kind of put my digital sketches. A couple of months before Kitbash started, which was September of. It'll be 3 years this year, so it's 2017, I think.
Okay, I want to say. That sounds about right, yeah.
Roughly, give or take a year is about the accuracy I have in that kind of thing. And so I started it completely anonymously. My now wife, then girlfriend, was the only person that really knew I was doing it, just because I kind of have like a perfectionist nature, and I wanted something where I could make things and share them, but not actually be like tickled by the like, this could be a little bit better, that could be a little bit better. And I happened to be like one of the first people to make an image for them. I had finished work one day, and I was looking through some design blog or a CG blog, and there's like Kitbash, you know, Gothic set. And I'm like, that looks like fun.
We should explain, because I know you and I know what Kitbash is, and some of our listeners may not have all that knowledge. So give a little synopsis of what Kitbash is. And you can, and also I'll let people know that you guys can go back and listen to the Max Berman podcast I did, because he talks about it as well if you want more detail. But give a quick summary if you can.
Yeah, so Kitbash is making kits of themed, mostly architectural models for people in the concept world, in game design or game production, to right. use as to create whatever they want, really, right? Like if you want to create an Art Deco world, there's an Art Deco kit for that. Then they consist, like generally speaking, of about 30 buildings per kit right. that all kind of fit into a style, whether it be Gothic, Deco, Modern, kind of all. They've got to be up to like 40 kits by now, I think.
They have a lot.
Yep. Yeah, a big catalog. And so they come textured and basically ready to roll. So if you're creating a world and you don't want to model every building in that world, because that would take ages and ages and ages, this will, you know, get you almost all the way there.
Right. It's really been very useful for concept artists to just throw in a bunch of buildings in the background, compose it the way they want. And then they can use that to paint over or just render, because they're all, like you said, they're texture ready and shader ready as well. I know there's there are V-Ray shaders on all of them as well, because mm-hmm. I work with Max, obviously.
Yeah, and yeah. Gave I was there for the development of all of that fun of getting all that ready.
Yeah. So it's a really cool, thing, that they've got.
You can do in a night, which would from scratch literally take a month and a half.
Right.
Right. And so especially for like ideation, kind of come up with maybe this could work, maybe this could work. What if we tweak this? You don't have to commit to any ideas,
right.
beforehand. You can just try a whole bunch of things really, really quickly. Which is why I saw that the night it came out just completely by chance. And I was like, yeah, I'll, you know, pour myself a whiskey. And 2 hours later I had an image and right. I posted it on Instagram and kind of forgot about it, to be honest. And like a month or two later, I got an email from Max and Banks saying, like, we want to give you your free kit. How can we get in contact with you? And at that point, Droki was still entirely anonymous.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, I guess this is the time I need to reveal who Droki is. and I actually didn't know I was in a competition at the time.
Right.
But I'm like, hey, a free kit's a free kit. Why not? Everyone loves 3D models.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing like a Kitmas Bash for them. It was kind of like a live streamed real-time art competition, concept art competition.
Nice.
Which was a lot of fun. And then shortly after that, they're like, do you want to come in and help kind of with the technical 3D supervision side of things?
Right.
And so it kind of grew naturally from there to the part where it was almost full-time. I was doing like little bits of ArcViz still with 3Marks. For a while, and now I'm kind of back to making images again.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, it was a wonderful time. The Kitbash guys are absolutely fantastic. Definitely listen to Max's episode and check out some free kits. They're always giving something away.
For sure. And actually, you know, I'd note that, you know, before all of this, pandemic hit us, anvil in the head, we were actually going to have you were actually going to be part of our Total Chaos, and we were going to work with you to do a bunch of stuff with Kitbash. So that specific idea has been put on hold, but the concept is still well alive. And so you and I are probably going to figure out some really cool stuff to do with Kitbash, probably a labs project or something like that in the near future. And so you and I'll talk about it after we've finished the podcast, but I still love the idea of what Kitbash is. And I still love the idea of how Max and Banks and all the team that you guys have, over there are thinking about it. And I think it's an important part of, really kind of a cool idea in terms of what it is. And, you know, Kitbash is not a new idea. It's, you know, in terms of the physical world, that's how the Millennium Falcon got built, right? They built the rough shape and then they took all these kits from, you know, different model shops and just stuck them on to give it a little bit more nerdiness and detail. And that's really what it's all about. And it looks great. So that's the kind of cool stuff. And actually Max comes from the practical world too. So he knows that very well.
Yeah. I mean, he has a lineage in it, right? Yeah. And like the coolest thing is that it's serving the same exact purpose, right? Like to do all of those, you sound like a Nernies man. I'm a Greebles guy, but right. Nonetheless, to do all of those little details would just take forever if you were trying to do them all, you know, bespoke for each and every one, right? And they need to be there, especially in a digital image, which has a tendency to lack those types of details.
Right.
And so they actually, I teach like a weekend workshop at Maddie in Venice every year, which is Maddie is Italian for Master of Architectural Design and Visualization of some sort. And so it's for architectural visualization specifically. It's a post-professional degree, and it's 1 year long. And when I go out there, you know, Kitbash provides all of the students with kits, and I actually teach them that if you want to get better at image making, right, in architectural visualization, whether that's film, VR, or stills, you need to find a way to practice that is not just modeling, right? If you want to make a cityscape from scratch, most of your time is going to be spent modeling, which means that's not going to make a better image or tell a better story. And so you need to find a way to practice efficiently, which is the thing that I've always personally been most drawn to with the kits, right? Is that you can create something you're proud of while focusing on the more artistic and less technical sides of the craft.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot to, making an image involves a lot more, right? Imagine if you were doing an interior and you modeled every chair and every plant. I mean, it would not make any sense, right?
So, you make like one image a year, and it would probably be a bit hard to get by on
that. So it'd be better to have a library of chairs and plants that you can use to populate your interior space if you're going to do that, and focus on what's important to do, right?
Yes, making it beautiful.
Right. And there's a lot to be said about that as well. And composition and lighting and shading and all those things are things that you can still focus on in terms of the idea. And modeling is fun if you just want to put your headphones on and not think too much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At least furniture. I hate modeling buildings. I'm an architectural visualization artist that hates modeling architecture. Give me a chair all day long.
You know, it's funny because I was my first, you know, I did at Gensler, I was working there. And then my first job in visual effects was modeling buildings, right? And so I was modeling it for Day After Tomorrow. My very next job was lighting lead on for iRobot. And I haven't modeled since. I have not touched.
No one can see this, but I'm applauding you. it's a necessary evil in CG, and some people really, really love it, but for me, the lighting, composing, right, like the mood and atmosphere of an image is the thing that really gets me excited and in love with what I get to do every day.
That's awesome. But let's go back to that. So you are head of 3D at Kitbash, is that what your title is? Is that what you said you were?
Was, yeah. We split ways back in November.
Oh, okay.
So I was head of 3D there for 2 years, thereabouts, roughly speaking. Again, we've already established I'm not great with timelines.
Right.
Their team is growing rapidly.
Right, right.
And I like making art, essentially. Okay. So like what they needed and what I wanted to be doing all day, kind of those paths started to diverge.
So you focus back on your architecture visualization group, right?
Architectural visualization, and I'm still making lots of sketches on Droki and back to more pushing pixels, let's say.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, then let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what are some of the pushing pixels things that you're actually involving in right now?
So I can't talk about any of the things that I'm currently working on as per normal in ArcViz. In about a year and a half, they'll all be out. Most of my work tends to be in the kind of luxury residential world, I think.
Yep.
Probably because I came from D-Box, which they tend to be in that niche. The vast majority of my work's there. So usually big projects, a lot of towers in New York City. Projects that generally are looking at like 30 to 50 images per project to market it and to sell it before it actually gets built. And so my whole focus, the thing that I kind of get most excited about from the business side of making art is how can we refine that client relationship such that I'm loving every minute of making images and you guys are super happy with what I make at the end. Okay. Which was kind of that initial impetus to leave D-Box when I did was how can we figure out that relationship such that I'm not frustrated because I'm making changes that I think are making the images worse, and you're not frustrated because you feel like you're not getting the images that you thought you needed. Right. Which I think, as a young artist, you think that if you make great art, if you make beautiful imagery, that will be solved just by making the great images.
Right,
and I
right.
think that the truth of that is that that's a client relationship and communication and process question.
Okay.
More than anything else.
Great. Yeah. But there is something I remember. So what the first, like, we should tell people, the first time that you and I met in person was actually at the ASAI conference here in LA.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Back in November or the fall, anyways.
Something like that. Yeah. Again, we are both bad at timelines right now. But yeah, it was around that time. And you gave a really interesting talk about how to think about images and how to charge people for what the work you're doing. And I thought it was a really great idea for people to understand the difference between, you know, what it was, because so much of the architecture visualization world, and I'm talking about even before digital, was all based on it costs you, you know, X amount of dollars per image, right? You need a rendering, it's this many. You need five renderings, it's this many. You need and this many times five, right? You know, so mm-hmm. It was always the same thing. And there was a thing that you said that basically said, no, I'm going to not pretend that the second image of the same space shouldn't cost as much as the first image. And I'm going to look at it very differently. And I'm going to offer something that's going to be more valuable to the customer. And you did it in a way that didn't make it seem that you were basically going to undercut everyone, but you were just giving the reality to the customer. So can you just give me that philosophy? Because you had a really great pitch. I know I'm paraphrasing, but I was thinking about it for a long time. So just give that pitch. Like, because if anyone's going out there, because we have a ton of people that do architecture visualization that listen to that. A lot of people that are, you know, sitting in their basement churning out renderings for people, mm-hmm. and your philosophy was really interesting. So go ahead and tell that story, because that was really good.
I will, and I'm so happy to hear that it resonated. So like the traditional model, if we look where it came from, the traditional model of CG had so much work done in post, and like all of these, every little flower was added and adjusted in Photoshop. And so you really had to lock in a camera at the very beginning and say, the camera's not going to move now, right? So as to not have to redo work down the line. Yeah. But render engines have gotten, you know, in the last 3 years, let alone the last 10 or 15 years, have gotten so much more powerful that the raw output from these things is pretty close to finished, right? At least for my workflow. I should probably caveat the whole thing that this works for me.
And there's also enough content out there that you can get a bunch of models of flowers or building, you know, of people and furniture, everything, right?
I mean, I've never modeled a flower, and on these projects, there's flowers, at least one in like every single shot, right?
Right, exactly.
And so the whole like prioritizing the entire process around like, we don't want to change the camera says, well, what if I need to change the couch? And yep. that means that the composition changes, right? Or we change the lighting and I want to make it wider. Well, now we've kind of set these things into place where we can't do that. And then you get the other side of that from the developer standpoint or the architect standpoint is, I'm paying you X thousand dollars to make this image of the living room. Let's say I want to see all of it. I want to see from edge to edge as much as possible, which means that, you know, if you show them three cameras, which generally in like the traditional process, you show three cameras, usually in like a white box kind of format of like camera A, B, or C, which one do you want? And usually, at least like in my experience, when I was doing that process, you'd show like one cool camera looking one direction, another cool camera showing another direction, and then another camera that's kind of like merging the two, right? And it's not that it's taking the best of both worlds, it's just losing the best of each image. And then without fail, the client's like, oh, those first two are really cool, but the third one, we can see everything. Let's go with that. And maybe we make the camera a little bit wider and show even more. Right. And so then of the three images, they pick the worst one and want to make it worse. And so then you're spending your entire time trying to make what's fundamentally a bad composition and a bad image good, which is you're working uphill the entire time. Whereas if you had a good composition from the beginning, every little detail doesn't need to be perfect for it to be still be a very strong image. And so kind of my philosophy with the clients, my clients is like, listen, I'm not going to give you camera options to choose from. I'm going to charge you for the space that you want to show. Okay. And sometimes that's one image for that space, and sometimes that's three images for that space. But I take the power of them getting to decide away, and I say, but I'm going to give you more images, and they're going to be easier for me to make because they're stronger images, right? And together they're going to show the space without me doing the one camera that's trying to pack it all into to one pork lens.
That's the thing, right? It becomes a practical problem because they're like, well, we're only paying for one image, so I got to show everything in that one image.
Exactly. And so, and everything's riding on it. And that's why they're like, what if the sky was just a little bluer and that chair was turned just a little bit? Because they're trying to get squeeze every last thing out of it.
Right.
Whereas if, you know, they say to me, like, we can't quite see this detail. I'm like, well, maybe I'll just do a little vignette shot. Look at, if you look at architectural visualization forums, it's filled with vignettes, right? These small little cool, beautiful, like, moments inside of pieces of architecture that clients do not pay for. Once in a blue moon, if it's a very special thing, clients are like, let's do that, but wider. Let's show more, right? Because they're paying for the same thing, but you already have the chair in the corner next to the window modeled and everything else.
Right.
Making that's fun. And then you can use the fact that you're making more to leverage, like, we're not going to change every little thing. We're not going to go through four rounds of review. I give my clients one round of review, right? Which is to say, if you don't like the cameras I've given, I'll find one that works for you.
Sure.
But we're not going to go through and nitpick every little pixel because that doesn't really matter. But if it's missing something and it's easier just to give you another image than to try to squeeze it into this one,
right?
I'd much rather make two strong images than one mediocre one. Right. Like, I enjoy that more. So you can leverage it within your relationship with the client as well.
Because, as you know, like you were saying, especially now that things have gotten so much faster and better, and your assets and your library of content has gotten richer. It's really, let's not lie. It is actually not that hard to do that second image.
No, if you can do the first one well, you can do the second one.
And if you can
quickly
solve all of your problems by doing a second image, as opposed to tweaking the crap out of the first one and making it worse.
that's exactly like the impetus of the entire, you know, exercise of what I've been trying to figure out. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, we had an interesting conversation about like that singular architectural image when we were at Noman. And we were talking about, is the single image dead? And I don't think that the single image of like, this is like the iconic photograph that captures the building, that's not dead at all. But the client wants to see that only, you know, with a lens that's 10 millimeters wider.
Right.
Right. And so if you want to make all of the cool shots too, you're either doing them in your free time or you're figuring out a way to leverage that. So listen, I'll make the image you want and the image that I want, and together they'll be better and we'll all be happy. But I can't do four rounds of like taking out clouds one by one.
Yeah. Yeah. We should actually explain to people what that was, because it was, you know, besides your talk, you and I and several other people were on a panel to talk specifically about, you know, what the world of visualization has become today, and especially in the digital world, and whether a static image is still a valid thing for architecture. Obviously, you know, the days of a shiny brochure are not as big as they used to be.
No.
The days of a website are definitely still around. And so there's a website and there's going to be images on that website. But there's a lot more kinds of content that's being developed out there. There's, you know, moving images and interactive image interactive content and stuff of that nature. What is your impression of that world and how that's, you know, what that means?
You know, I'm all for it, right? Like I've never done anything in VR as far as created it. And there's a lot of people that are kind of in my shoes that are like making stills or maybe even animations or films, however they want to call them, that are very worried about this movement. I think it's an amazing tool that does a lot of things that I don't want to try to do in still images anyways. Right. Like it's one more tool for a developer to describe a project, and it takes its effect on the still image, I think, is that it takes away the explanatory role. It's like, that's the part that it's chipping away at. And so like the aerial image that kind of shows how it sits on the block and that takes forever to make, and it's never usually that much fun. That's better done in VR or AR, right? Like you can give a better client experience of describing and understanding that space and that, and the relationship to the buildings itself. If someone can look around, or even like the VRs where you look down at a flat map and through a phone or a tablet, you can actually, you know, walk around the map and actually kind of look at it from like a God's eye view. Those are amazing, amazing tools. I think that the pressure that it's going to put on the still side of things, because like my love is for the still image.
Yeah, of course.
The pressure
going away.
No, right. Like photography still exists.
Right.
And, but like, think of like what's happened with photography. I think that, that CG, especially architectural visualization, is going through a very, very analogous time, which is that, whereas 25 years ago, if you had the equipment to do professional photography, your level of competence or artistic merit was less important, than it is now. Right.
Okay.
Because now everyone has that equipment. So the only thing differentiating you is kind of the soft skills of how you're using it. Mm-hmm. Right. And you could go back 100 years, literally you had to be a chemist to be a photographer. Right.
Right.
It was more of a scientific than an artistic job. And so, but now we have, you know, professionally, what would have counted 20 years ago as a professional quality phone or camera on our phone. And so it's really said like, your unique take and your voice through that medium is what is separating architectural photographers and all photographers. Right. And I think that with CG, especially with the advent of VR and AR becoming more and more predominant as a means to explain projects, but also the fact that like render engines are really good now.
Yeah.
Right. It's not hard just to make a photorealistic image. Nope. It's just like, it doesn't take a lot of technical know-how. So now if anybody can do that, what separates, you know, like an average architectural visualization render from like an architect or from a not particularly gifted studio versus one that's actually worth paying money for?
Yeah, I agree. Now tell me if you agree with this, because I'm sure you will. But I work for Chaos Group. We make V-Ray, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact is, you do not need, you shouldn't be spending most of your time learning V-Ray. In fact, if you're spending a lot of time learning V-Ray, then you're not necessarily using V-Ray correctly, because V-Ray out of the box should work pretty well. It's not, I mean, you shouldn't be tweaking a bunch of settings, right? Default settings is way better than anything else. So instead of spending your time learning how to use V-Ray, spend your time learning how to compose an image or how to like, these are skills that are much harder to master and take a lot more practice than that it should be done and should be learned in that way. You know,
I couldn't possibly agree with that more. 'Cause 10 years ago, right? Like you had to kind of understand an irradiance map to get a good result. And even if you
you need to know how to tweak it for every image and every condition.
Exactly.
Now, if you're using an irradiance map, I'm going to come by your house. I'm going to slap your hand.
the difference in like the settings that I change is like sample count is about the amount of tweaking that I do. And usually I just leave.
You're not using irradiance maps, are you still?
No.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. -4, -2.
Oh, no. I'm coming over. I'm slapping your hand. I don't care about this virus.
Right? Like, really, at the end of the day, I changed the resolution and I let it render a little bit longer
from
draft to final, right? And at the same time, even if you knew all of those settings backwards and forwards, like as much as, you know, your best developer did as far as understanding them, the results that you can get now blow anything that was even
right
close to it, like as straight out of the frame buffer, you know, 10 years ago, like couldn't touch a bad test rendering now.
Right.
As far as quality goes.
Yeah. And the fact is, I mean, you know, especially, you know, in things like V-Ray, these are systems that are based on physics, right? So real, mm-hmm. real systems, right? So really your camera is way closer to a physical camera than reality, right? So if you put real, if you just used materials the way they are and put them on there and they represent things, they will react like they would in any kind of physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore you, it's really like taking a photograph, at which point you have control of everything that a photographer has, what it looks like, what depth of field are you going to use? What f-stop are you going to use, right? What kind of lighting? Do you want a cloudy day? You know what? You have the power to move the sun, which a photographer does not have. So you
get to play God.
You can play God, right? So there are definitely a lot of things that you can do out there to create a great image, and it comes from art.
And those are the hard things to learn, right? Like,
yeah.
I can tell you, I can still kick off some irradiance map numbers if someone wants to try V-Ray 1.6, and like it wouldn't take that long to understand them. Yeah. But as far as like, why is this composition better than that composition, or why did you move the light to, you know, 110 degrees askew from the camera as opposed to 45 degrees, right? Right. Like those are, every case is different, right? Like, and it's, yeah. it's just takes a lot of time and practice. And I think, struggle basically of like fighting with, why doesn't this look good? Does this look better? Does that look better? Oh, this time that looks better. And then trying to understand. I think it's
because
that.
People want to have a way to quantify what's good and what's bad. Right. And if I tell them this setting is bad, then it's easy to quantify that.
Yeah. And like, if you say backlighting an image is bad and they take that into their head, they'll never backlight an image. But sometimes that's wrong. The best way to do things. Right.
That's the thing that frustrated me in VR, because there were so many quote unquote rules to VR. And it's like, how can you have all these rules? It's such a new medium. Like, never move a camera. It's like, really? Okay. I understand the whole nausea thing. So maybe there's some things that we can follow there, but I actually saw a bunch of VR where people are moving camera where I didn't get nauseous. Right.
Yeah.
I get in a car every day. I don't get nauseous, and it moves.
It moves and I'm fine. And I'm on a plane, which I can't even see outside on, and I'm fine on that too.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know,
there's something called relative motion, right? And so there's acceleration and there's, you know, all these different things. So anyway, so it's just one of those things like you make people need something quantifiable to make it easier for them to understand or to learn from. And it's really, really hard. I remember, man, when I was when I started an architecture school, and I loved art. So I was a double major in math and fine arts,
mm-hmm. which is an amazing combo.
Yeah. And I went to architecture school, which seemed way more analytical in some ways compared to fine arts.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started, you know, here's your problem, right? Because architecture is presented as a problem. Art is not presented as a problem.
But a design degree is providing solutions that other people wouldn't think of.
Right. So here's a problem. And I'm like, great, this is a math problem. I'm like, no, because the result is subjective. And I'm like, but there's got to be a solution, you know? And it was so hard for me to come up with that grasp of like, you know, I mean, you got to have that. I mean, it's the same thing when you're doing your images. Here's your problem. You have the problem is you have this space and you've got to make it look good. Your result is subjective in the end.
Yep.
You can achieve the goal, but it's a subjective result. So that's got to be fascinating, right?
Well, it's such a hard thing to wrap your head around, because you have to say you can work forever on these problems, right? Like,
That's you don't know when to stop.
There's no like, I've got it. This is the answer. It can't get any better. It can always get better, right? Like, when I was in architecture school, which was the first time that I like you was dealing with this issue of like, I'm solving a problem that doesn't have a set solution. There's multiple solutions, and whatever I come up with could always be better.
Right.
And I went nuts. Like during architect school, I lost like 40 pounds.
Really?
A lot, you know, cause I didn't sleep. I slept like a couple hours a night at most. Right. And, when I don't sleep, I'd lose my appetite. It wasn't like an eating problem or anything else. It was just 2 days would go by and I'd realize I hadn't eaten anything besides 3 gallons of coffee. And so like you have to start like learning of like, okay, I need to find a pace for myself where I'm saying, like, I think this will read better. And then you have to continue refining that, because if you're doing this as a job, your opinion's not the most important opinion at the end of the day.
Right.
If we all just made the images that we wanted to make, no one would ever get paid.
True. Yeah.
you know?
Well, what's the, I mean, there's several ways to look at that. It's not the best, but what's the George Clooney method about making movies?
I don't know if I know that.
Two for them, one for me.
You basically just kind of summed up my process that we were talking about before, right?
Right.
I'm going to make sure they get the images they want. And like having the more experience you have, the more you have a better sense of that. But like you need to get something out of it. Otherwise, you can make more money doing something else in a lot less time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the VR thing, to go back to the VR thing, because I think it's so interesting. And the conversation that we had at Noman, I thought was really fascinating to see how architects are using VR to interface directly with their clients, right? Like, you know, I'm a big fan of not showing my clients any work that doesn't look good. And they're showing them buildings that are white box modeled.
Right.
And having great success with it, because it almost starts to bring back, I feel like it's so far back in like the not polished stage that it gets almost to the old sketch, right? In the sense of, if you look at like a bad photorealistic rendering, it just looks bad and you're going to assume that what it's portraying is bad. You're not going to separate the bad image from the bad architecture or design.
Sure.
Right? And that's one of the things that Thomas Johansson was really big on, and why he hired me, was that he found that when he used to show things in just 2D drawings and material samples, so that the client had to imagine what the space was going to look like,
they couldn't make the jump.
No, that he didn't have any problem with.
Oh, okay.
Here's an elevation and like maybe like a perspective line drawing, right? Even tune shader. And here's like the beautiful marble that's going to be here and the beautiful wood and all that. And the client could make the jump. But as soon as he had like some of his like junior architects that knew a little bit of rendering make a bad attempt at photorealism, that's what stopped them dead in the tracks.
Interesting. So they could imagine it with the physical materials,
actual samples,
and a rough representation of the space
that makes no, like literally a line drawing of an elevation
so that
there's nothing photorealistic for them to kind of feed off of. It's entirely imagined, right, as opposed to giving them just enough to be like, ah, that doesn't look good, yeah, but it's not a good rendering, you have to imagine it. Well, if you show them a little bit, they get stuck there. And I feel like with the VR, they get the chance to be like, this is what the space is, but it's clearly not finished because it's all white. So like, okay. I don't show white images ever to my clients because I'm not selling a design. I'm selling my portrayal of that design.
So because I like to relate everything to everything, would you say that what the semi-realistic images that a junior architects were doing was kind of like the uncanny valley of ArcVis?
That's exactly what I would call it.
Right?
It's exactly, because it's too close to being photorealistic not to be off.
That it confuses them as to what the realism is, right?
Exactly. Like a sketch is a sketch. You know that, like if it's literally drawn, you know that it's not a photograph.
So you can fill in all the blanks in your mind, but if someone is too close to filling in the blanks, you can't make the jump to what it's going to be, right?
Yep. Have you read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics?
No, but I've heard of it. Yeah. Is it about the space between the comic book lines?
That's one of my favorite parts of the book. Yes. The gap.
I haven't read it, but my friend Dan Thron, he mentions that a lot. He's like, it's the anticipation of the punch and then the after the punch. And then in between there is the punch, but somehow you filled in your mind that something got punched. But
in the gutter, it happens in everyone's mind. We're all complicit.
Right.
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 And the same thing, he has a like the chart, like the ultimate abstraction is a word, right? And then you have like a stick figure. We can draw a smiley face and everyone is happy to imagine that as a human, right? Two dots and a arc. a smiling human. And right. depending on how you're telling the story, they can place themselves, they can personify themselves into that, those three little marks. But right. as you get closer and closer to a photograph of a human or something that actually resembles them, your right. attachment and closeness to that gets further and further away. Right. And he looks at like a lot of Japanese comics, which are rendered, some of them are rendered almost photorealistically in the background. Right. Mm-hmm. Still drawn, but like to a very realist nature. And then you get to the faces, like manga faces. Again, a yeah. couple of lines. Keep it simple, because if you get too close, even in a comic, which is supposed to be drawn, you, that uncanny valley still exists, not just in right. film and CG.
Yep. I totally get it. I've somehow over the years, I've found so many things that are become the uncanny valley of some kind. I even saw a joke at one point that said that Canada is the uncanny valley of the United States. It's kind of close to American, but not quite. So when you get there, you're a little confused.
Doesn't sound right. People are smiling.
I love Canadians. So don't, they're just too polite, you know, just a little bit too. It confuses you.
Well, especially if you were expecting New Yorkers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. Anyway, so yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree that that's the case. And then, you know, there is so much that you can do to fill in the blanks, right, in your mind. And your imagination is so much more powerful than something that's being represented in some kind. And unless you're going to go all the way and represent it 100% real, it's just never going to be there. And it's just going to confuse people in the end. So, yeah, totally makes sense.
And, you know, there's a interesting correlation to that, or at least that I think is a correlation. It's not so much an uncanny valley, but it's like where you're putting focus, especially yeah. in a still image. You know, the architect Cabuzier, Le Corbusier?
Oh, of course.
Right. He actually did a lot of architectural photography right. as like a hobby while he was designing and kind of defining modernism. And mm-hmm. he has this one picture. I want to say it's in Villa Savoie, but it doesn't really matter. It's in a kitchen. Okay. And you know, like it's a one-point perspective. It's a very clean, well-composed photograph. But there's a half-eaten, like sliced loaf of bread sitting on the table. The door is ajar, and the like one of the cabinets is pulled open just a little bit.
Okay.
And when you look at that image, you obviously see the architecture. You like the space is assumed, because what you're trying to figure out is why is the thing open and the door open, and where the either something just happened or something's about to happen.
Right.
Right. And so in your brain, as opposed to focusing on just the architecture, you just put yourself into the architecture to try to figure out the story. Right.
Right.
And as a result, you can't help but imagine the space, right. which is like, I think the most successful images, whether they're it's concept art drawings or anything else, gets a viewer to have it live in their own minds. It's like, it's the, you know, issue with like the old, why the old Alien and Predator were so good, right?
Right.
You had to pretty much imagine them so you could make it as terrifying as possible for you.
Right.
Exactly. And so anything that
don't
like,
show the monster,
don't show the monster. Right.
Right.
No matter how good the CGI is, don't show the monster.
Yeah. It's way scarier in your mind.
Yeah. And so, like, what are the other tricks? Like, I think that the same things that get you stuck in the uncanny valley are also the techniques that you can potentially get out of it. Isn't just a technical exercise. It's yeah, also yeah, a creative yeah. storytelling one.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I remember this, and I'm actually curious to hear your thoughts, because this has got to be in the very late 90s, early 2000s that I remember this. You know, I was obviously, you know, coming out of architecture school, everyone said they want to do an architecture walkthrough animation, right? Mm-hmm. It was the worst exercise. We've obviously since graduated from that, creatively speaking, but it was literally people moving a camera forward as 1,000 frames through a space. And it was like a Hitchcock nightmare going through their architecture space.
And as unsettling.
The way Lon described it is let me sit you down in a wheelbarrow and walk you through a space and tell me how that feels.
That's an amazing description. My hat's off to Lon on that. That is so good.
That's really good. So I was thinking, it's like there's got to be a better way. And obviously filmmaking has a history of how to show spaces and how to make it work. But around that time, there was a TV show that came out, which was related to Dwell Magazine. Do you remember Dwell Magazine?
It's I remember the magazine. I'm not sure if I...
So they made a TV show that was basically like, hey, we're going to show you some cool architecture spaces. But it was like, you know, like they'll show three cool architects that are around Austin or whatever it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would film it. They had a guy filming it or a girl filming it, whoever. And it was filmed mostly static shots, maybe a little bit of a pan.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had like one of the residents, like just in the background, just walking down the steps, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was just like that Villa Savoy image or Corbusier image you were talking about. It's like it was just something that gave like, oh, well, that's the normal life situation, right?
There's
like,
a thing.
You can
There's
imagine what that imagine. Person is. Yeah, you can imagine that person is, you know, going upstairs to, you know, check on the laundry or whatever it was. You know, like your imagination could think about that. And it just felt suddenly, because if you look at all these old Architecture Digest magazines, everything looks so sterile and cold because there's no one in the images. There's no life in the images. And it just because things were just a little bit moving, a little bit of life, especially human life in that thing. Sometimes it wasn't human life. Sometimes it was literally a thing. And then there was like a cat in the window, right? Perfect. Well,
did you see, I mean, I'm sure you saw Alex Roman's Third and Seventh.
Of course.
Right? Which is
yes.
an absolutely that beautiful.
That redefined ArcViz forever.
It still is. Like there are. It
still does.
There it is at least 10 years old now, right?
Oh, at
Probably,
least.
Probably. At least. Right?
At least.
And it's because it's not relying on any type of like technical tricks. It's like beautifully lit, beautifully choreographed. The cinematography is stunning. Everything has a little bit of movement, whether it's the leaves or him there as a photographer or like the mm-hmm. shifting of the light. There's just enough. It's beautiful. And I don't think that anyone's with all of the technology we've had since then. I don't think and I've never seen an architectural film that I'd say is better than that.
No, and at the very least, that's their aspiration.
Oh, you see it being copied. That's everywhere.
What everyone is ripping them off, right? Or I don't want to say it. Everyone is inspired by it. Well, I won't say rip them off, because, but everyone's inspired by it, and it was really sort of like I said, it was the defining moment where ArcViz rethought everything, and it wasn't just ArcViz, by the way. It was highly regarded. I don't know if you know this or not. But we all saw it when I was a DD at the time when it came out, and everyone was like, what the hell?
Who is this miracle?
And they're
man.
Like, and these are like some of the top visual effects artists in the world. And they're like, I don't know. And I was like, oh, I know exactly. And he's like, this was done. And this is what killed them all. It's like, this was done with Max and V-Ray. And they're like, no, I refuse to believe that. This involved a team of people. Nope, this was probably one guy in his basement, and he was just very talented, and he used real lighting and real photography concepts to make this happen. But one of the people, for example, that this sort of like got someone's attention was actually David Fincher. I don't know if you know that. David Fincher
no.
reached out to him, yeah. And so Alex Roman, we actually ended up working with him on a few shots that David gave him for A Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah,
He doesn't have like much of an online presence. He's been teasing a new film about, I think, dance or ballerinas or something.
I've been wanting to have him on the podcast and talk to him. Apparently he's very hard to get a hold of or to nail down, but yeah, that's it's a big part. Yeah. He's very important, but I do see it. You know, if you look at most ArcViz today, or at least at the very least, anyone that's doing like what you're saying, the personal work, right.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to sell Third and Seventh to a client as a style, because it's not going to work for them, for the marketing department.
maybe for an architect that's pitching the design for competition, maybe.
Okay. Right.
But not for let's sell $40 million condos. Yeah, that's not happening.
Right. I don't understand. Where's my picture of the sauna?
You know, I'm curious actually. I love how much we have in common, but obviously like you have so much experience in like the film and VFX world.
Yeah.
That I'd be curious to know your thoughts on another thing that he does really well in the third and seventh, and Scott McCloud talks about at length in Understanding Comics, which is that Japanese comics tend to start, as opposed to, like, you can think of like a movie opening where they show like the wide shot of the city, right?
Right.
Which is saying, this is LA and this is where our story will unfold.
Right.
They tend
establishing shots.
Establishing shots, right?
Right.
And like most American comics, like that's the first bar is like, here's the house that something's going to take place in or whatever it might be.
Right.
And he argues for the Japanese style, which I tend to agree with, which is that they generally will start with like little vignettes. So if it's a house on a big yard with like beautiful trees and it's a beautiful day, they'll show like a close up of the leaves. They'll show up like maybe a bird or grass or like a close up of clouds moving, maybe a detail of the house, right? All of these things that kind of together form the whole house or city. And then they, after you've already kind of imagined it for yourself, then they say, yes, this is the house.
Yeah.
And it's like that same idea of imagination. It's just, you know, getting the person, the viewer involved intimately.
Right. Well, I think that's a great, idea, honestly speaking, because I think it sort of sets a mood rather than a reference overall. Right. So you set the mood of the thing. I sort of equate it to waking up, right? When I wake up in the morning, the first thing I see, because I don't, you know, I'm not, oh, my glasses on, is a blurry something, right? And so then I can see my phone at the edge, and then I like realize this is open, and then I see how much light's coming through the window. And so then that's my day kind of starts. And then after I've gone through all those things and I put my glasses on, I walk out, then I see the whole living room, and then I see the coffee maker, you know, and like that's the process of which me waking up happens. And so it starts off like really detailed, like this, you know, like putting my hand in front of my face, like here's my you know, thing that's like, you know, 4 inches from my face. That's how I wake up.
and slowly the whole picture gets pieced
and
together.
Slowly the whole picture reveals. But you know what that looks like, and when you wake up in the morning, I, you know, when I wake up, I don't see all of Burbank.
Thank God.
That would be really scary.
That's not the first thing you want to see right thing in the morning. You gotta get coffee in you first. Get that full picture of a black cup of coffee. But yeah, I think that like this idea of, because it's also saying that I'm not just showing you a thing, right? And I think that like effective films do this really well too, which is saying like, we're going on this ride or journey together.
Right.
And we're going to figure things out together, as opposed to here's the thing. What do you think?
Right.
And that's all soft skills, right? Like that, I think that all of the things we're talking about is why third and seventh still hold up. Why we still talk about Hitchcock, right? Because that wheelbarrow ride is really unsettling, and he was going for unsettling.
Yeah. When you're wandering around the house in Psycho, and you know that was disturbing.
Yeah. Or when you see little bits of things happen in rear window, and you don't see all of it, like that's, you want to know what happened behind the wall that's not in front of the window. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's such a wonderful thing.
Perfect. Well, Mike, this has been great. I think we're definitely going to have you back, and we have a lot more to discuss, but it's been an hour, and this has been a fantastic discussion. I really appreciate you coming on, man.
I thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I'm so happy that we finally got to sit down.
I know. I love this idea. And you know, the thing that we were talking about at the beginning, that you know, we don't always have those opportunities, and I think it's great that it's like, I've been sitting here waiting. It's like, well, when are we going to see Mike again when he comes to LA or something like that? And it's like, you know what? Screw it. We can just do it like this. So, and this has been working out great. So, I really hope that we can, we'll keep this going for sure.
Well, thank you again for having me. I very much appreciate it. I wish you the best of luck with, you know, the Chaos team and dealing with everything we got going on, and can't wait to see what you guys are doing next, because I've seen a little bit of it and it's exciting.
Thank you.